Welcome to another episode of Elaborate Topics Podcast. I'm so excited about this episode. We are going to have an amazing conversation with an amazing guest, Dr. Rodney Rohde.
Welcome to the Elaborate Topics Podcast, where we focus on lab-specific strategies for medical laboratory professionals. We're proud to be the healthcare detectives that work behind the scenes to get the results needed to influence medical decisions. Let's grow together and jump right into the lab.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Stephanie. Hi, Taiwana. So excited about today's episode. And this is Elaborate Topics Podcast, which is a weekly podcast that airs every Tuesday. And we talk about tools and tips that you can use to excel inside and outside the lab. And today we're having a great topic, and I'm not going to give it away. I'm just going to say,
it's all in the name. It's all up to you. If you don't know Dr. Rodney Rohde, I'm going to actually read his bio. Dr. Rohde has published over 90 research articles and abstracts, 2 books, and he's a highly sought after keynote presenter with over 100 international, national, and state conference presentations. His 2 books focus on methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus adaptation and clinical consideration in rabies. In recent years, he has become a globally viral author subject matter expert, utilizing invited articles, TEDx talks, podcasts, videocasts, and interviews to enhance science communication and translational health research literacy in public health, healthcare, and medical laboratory environment. And during the SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19 pandemic, Dr. R is the number one quoted Texas state subject matter expert and conducted over 150 interviews for podcasts, TV, newspaper, and internet sites, including dozens of webinars and workshops at all levels. He has received numerous awards and honors during his career, and most recently added to the Pathologist Power List 2020 and Cardinal Health's Laboratory Excellent List in 2022. Welcome, Dr. Rohde.
Thank you so much for that very kind introduction. Wow, I hope everybody's still here. Thank you. It is an honor and a pleasure to be with you guys. I love your podcast, and I'm excited to join you today.
Awesome.
So for all of our listeners today, just like Lona said, we're going to be talking about it's all in a name. And by that, we mean our laboratory profession. Many of us have so many different skills, specializations, from cytogenetics to histology to autopsy to cytologist to medical laboratory scientist. But many times in healthcare, we get lumped into med tech or lab tech. Or even when we talk about ourselves, I'm just a tech. And there has really been a push, and that's what Dr. Rohde is here to educate and talk about his own initiatives today. But there's really been a push over the past few years for us to standardize. There's a lot of great literature that I'll include in the show notes, but one is an article named Standardizing the Professional Title of Medical Laboratory Professionals, and it came out from ASCLS. And I want to read a quick quote as we begin our talk today from this article. And a portion of this article reads, "Part of properly communicating our contribution to healthcare systems depends on us, all of us lab people, being able to articulate who we are in terms of our job titles. Given the threat to our workforce, there's been a hard stance on urging professionals to make necessary changes to ensure the names of educational programs, our industry titles, and our credentials are aligned." And so as we talk about the importance of our nomenclature initiative and our nomenclature problem, for all the listeners who may not be aware or maybe using old nomenclature and just didn't understand the importance of changing the three letters behind their name or why they need to take this stance. Can you give us a little bit of background for the standardization of the nomenclature in the lab profession?
Yeah, historically, you laid it out a little bit historically. So I've been in the field about 22 years now, because again, I transitioned from public health laboratories into the medical laboratory arena back in 2002. And so my story starts out, as I've discussed many times, that when I was working on my two degrees as an undergrad and a master's student, I really didn't know anything about back then medical technology. And literally the program was across the street from where I did my two degrees. So I went 7 years getting two degrees and had never heard about credentials or certification or licensure or any of these other things we think about. And so that was my introduction, is when I left and took a job in the public health world, I started seeing people's names on their name tags and these letters behind it, and started asking the questions and understanding that, oh, okay, there's actually a credential to work in a medical laboratory. And again, that was a really big learning point for me. And it just percolated for a few years. But what I did, thankfully, looking back, is I said, I'd like some of that. And so what I did is I did the work route. Early in my career, I started documenting all the areas I was working, massive time in microbiology, virology, molecular diagnostics, immunology, and started getting those things taken care of. That was the first 10 years of my career. And so that was my experience. That was my walk. And then all of a sudden, through an opportunity of adjuncting back at Texas State, just out of nowhere, a colleague knew that there was a position in the medical lab science. At that point, it was the clinical lab science program, and they needed a microbiologist and molecular expert. And so I was like, oh, that's interesting. And he said, why don't you give it a look? And so the rest is history. I switched careers in 02 and ended up in the very program that I didn't know existed about 10 years earlier. That was my story. And then I really was fortunate, and I know you guys know this as well in your walk, but all of these mentors within ASCP and ASCLS and ASM and other places, APHL, that really helped me to understand the field. Right. So I really learned over the first 5 or 10 years of my career. I joined all these wonderful professional organizations and started understanding kind of the background. And the first thing I remember thinking to myself was, this is an interesting problem. I've been a public health microbiologist for a decade and everybody knew who I was in that realm. But now I was getting this feeling that people were sometimes struggling with, am I a med tech? Am I a clinical lab scientist? Am I a medical lab scientist? Why does my credential not equal my degree? Just all of that, right? So there was a lot of confusion. And I think it goes without saying that if you can't identify yourself, a professional identity, it's difficult to get that awareness and visibility down to the middle school, to the high school student, to the early college student, and even to the general public. We all know that's been an ongoing process. It's getting better. I think we're doing a great job getting it out in front of the public and changing that professional identity. But back then, 15, 20 years ago, it was on everybody's mind. And so that's my immersion into it. And at some point, I know we'll transition into the recent work that I've been doing as a medical lab science program director and how I got that name there. But really, that awareness and visibility for me became so important because of the students I teach. And because of the other people out there that I cherish, that are colleagues, and how can we get ourselves out in front of the world so that people know what a medical laboratory professional does and what we do to save lives every day.
Wow. Dr. Rohde, I'm happy we're having this discussion, because we actually had a program director reach out to us about this very topic. So they were interested in the nomenclature and name change. And so as I think back over my own career and think about how confusing it could be with the lack of standardization. So my degree says clinical laboratory science. So I have a bachelor's of clinical laboratory science, but I had to do my clinical training at another facility because my program, I was actually the last person from my university, Kentucky State University, that was awarded a degree in clinical laboratory science. But I did my clinical training at the University of Cincinnati, whose program was medical laboratory science. I graduated with a clinical laboratory science degree, did my clinical training through a program that was medical laboratory science. And when I got my certification, I was medical technologist, ASCP. So that can definitely be very confusing. And then after being in the profession for some time, it was, oh, you are now MLS ASCP. You've been grandfathered and converted over to medical laboratory scientist ASCP. So it can be very confusing, and that lack of standardization can create some challenges. And you talked a little bit about it. But as we were getting ready for this episode, I went back to some of the resources and looked at that ASCLS article. And one of the things, another thing that they mentioned in that article was about not having that standardization and nomenclature among employers leads to confusion, as well as in regards to pay grade, educational programs, regulatory agencies, certification agencies, and the public. Because at my organization, we, our job title, whether you are MLT or MLS, is medical technologist, MT. So again, still more confusion and still not standard with the industry. I guess my question for you is, how is this lack of standardization impacted and compounded our workforce challenges as we are trying to recruit and retain the best of the best, but we have this, you know, difference in program names as well as difference in job titles, and we do still have people who are very proud to be lab techs, to be just the tech, as Stephanie said. So I'm curious to hear your perspective.
Yeah. All really good points. It's such a big, complex web. And I think part of that speaks to the problem. And your experience, your example is really interesting, because, you know, I still have to talk about that in the sense that I had categorical certifications all over the place. So I often get the comment, man, what is all that alphabet soup behind your name? But they're hard earned and I want them there, but it does offer an opportunity to discuss that with people. So that's part of it. I think we could also throw in at one time, even in my time, when I first came into academia and started meeting everyone within our field, there was still the credential of CLS, all right? And so there was, just to throw in another acronym here, there was the clinical lab scientist credential from NCA, which was run through ASCLS. And so we had, and there's multiple credentials out there. And to make the point, which many of us have made, is if you're gonna be a particular healthcare professional as a nurse or a physician or something like that, it's one credential, it's one name. Now, you can have different specialties, right? There's gastroenterologist and there's rheumatologist and different types of physicians, but there's a name that people understand that you're a doctor or a physician or a nurse, even though there are variations. So I think that was the challenge. And I think just as a profession, and again, I'm going to say this very humbly, I came from a different place. I came out of public health. My world had been all about, and I cut my teeth there. And then when I came into the current kind of areas that I work in, ASCLS, ASCP, and others, and still APHL, it's, oh, this is interesting. There's actually hurdles and like walls between different credentials, and people are passionate about their degrees. Why wouldn't you be? People are, I'm sure you were proud of your degree. I'm proud of mine. But there had to be these conversations, I think, to try to get people, and we're still having them. This, again, doesn't happen overnight. Is you got to get people to understand that, can we have a common ground? Can we have a common degree? Can we have a common credential? Can we have a common transcript so that when you look at a transcript, people can understand that MLS is MLS versus MT and CLS and other prefixes that kind of have to be problematic. I just think that conversation has bubbled to the surface, especially in the last 5 years. There's a whole area when we get to talking about my opportunity to work at the national level on these workforce committees. Other groups are working on actual HR and job titles. That's out of my purview, but there are groups, subcommittees that are addressing visibility, workforce HR issues, building from below, from middle school, high school, and those types of opportunities, trying to really hit all the entry points for this issue. And we're probably still not getting them all, but we're starting and we're trying, and we're really working hard to be an umbrella with multiple laboratory organizations and entities, and also starting to try to think about, for example, what you guys probably know Jim Payne, what groups can we talk to at high school levels? What conferences do we need to be going to for advisors and counselors so that we get that name out there? And really one of my pushes in the last few years, because of this journey I've been on to change my own program from CLS to MLS, was to keep hammering the point every time I can. So I'm going to do it here now. The major, I need people that come into college to be told there is a medical laboratory science major, just like there's a nursing major, just like there's a biology major, just like there's engineering, whatever. That name needs to be front and foremost, so that they tie that major immediately to the profession. To me, I just think it's so important, because when I think of my own experience of microbiology is my bachelor's degree, that tied my brain to ASM, that tied my brain to microbiology. And I just think we need to tether it. Everything isn't a name, to your point. And so if that name is not similar, and it may not be perfect every time, but we need to get it as close to consolidation as we can so that it's helpful for everybody.
I'm from the old school that was MT. I was not in that group that changed over to MLS. But I think there's a lot of stuff going on, and it's good that we start with the institution where we're getting our degree. There's a lot of work that's going to have to happen on the job with all of us. Even at my job, we're called CLS. Even if they have an MLS, when you get to my job, you're based on the different ladder. Your CLS 1, CLS 2, CLS 4. So that's another thing that needs to be addressed. But let's start out with where you started, Dr. Rohde, because you could have a blueprint that will help a lot of different educational institutions. So tell us, as chair of your program, why was that important for you to work to change that program's name?
Yeah, so great. I think part of it was when I got here, and in the same journey, right? All of my predecessors, my former chair who hired me, he was a med tech and a CLS. He had both credentials. And I remember thinking, well, that's interesting that you have both. You only need one. And so that was my early experience. And I was a faculty member here as I grew into the chair position. And it often was confusing to students and to alumni, that CLS versus MLS versus the credential. And so it was just confusing to different people. And so that was part of it. When I became chair in 2013, my former chair, who was wonderful, Minnie Dave Fleur, he built this program. We started back in 74, I believe. So we've hit the 50-year anniversary of our program. It was what it was, med tech. And then he transitioned to CLS when that kind of happened, I think in the 80s sometime. And so it was just the journey. But when I got here, he had talked about it, but he was stepping out of his chair role, and the timing was just not quite right. It wasn't I think the energy just wasn't quite there nationally yet. Certain programs were doing it. It was sporadic as far as a program name change and a degree name change. And so when I came in 13, I was like, I'm just going to let it percolate for a little longer. And so that's what I did. And we all knew the day was coming that it would be important to make that change for awareness, for visibility. Students like that name for whatever reason. They want that credential and name to be consolidated. And so when the time came, and this is part of what we'll probably talk about soon, when ASCP and many other people in the laboratory community started this effort called the Blueprint for Action. For me, this was like in 2021, 2022, when they asked me to join that committee. that's was the trigger. That was what got me off my butt, in all honesty, got over the inertia, and I said, okay, I'm on this national committee. This is a perfect time. I'm going to have lots of resources, lots of people to help me. And so I started the process. And so 2022 is when that trigger got pulled, and it was a process, it was a journey, and I know we're going to talk about it, but just building up to that, it was really about name recognition, it was about recruiting, it was about getting people to understand our name and what we did, and you guys know how much we've all worked in that area. I certainly had been, I've been talking medical laboratory science for years, even though my name, my program name was still CLS, so it was good. It was a good time to make that change, and that's where we're at right now.
Awesome. So I know you said there were certain steps that just give us some high level, some of the steps that you took and any challenges that you had during that time.
Sure. I'll quickly mention, and Stephanie knows this, I sent her some resources. Again, I want to start with a very humble statement that this was more than Rodney. This was all of my faculty. This was alumni buy-in. This was my dean in college and other people above them. A lot of people, a lot of people helped me do this, as well as the professions, right? Across so many people, I can't name them all, but across so many sectors of the field that have been helpful during this. The first thing I did was I just needed to know the lay of the land. And so I literally, I guess the first thing I did, I started talking to this with my leadership. And so I went to them with some benchmarking. I went to them with some NACLS data. NACLS, as everyone knows, is our accreditation body. I started looking at the institutional process of how to do that. And so that was for me, this was the summer of 22, just a timeline. So that was a big view. And then I had to start meeting with faculty and talking to alumni and students and administrators. And we can go into the step by step if you want, but basically my dean came back to me and said, okay, we're going to need a proposal. We're going to need some information of why this is important, who's done it, what are the data, what's the percentages of people that have become MLS programs. And then from that point, it just really became for me, and again, keep in mind, I work for a university that's a state university in Texas, so it could be different across the country, but I did document this. And for me, it became a what's the process policy-wise to change a program name? And there is a process, and I'm sure every university has this. And so that's where I started. And if you want to get into weeds, we can walk through that. But it was a process, and it's not as bad as you might think it is. It was just a sustained effort over about an 18-month, 2-year period. Nothing moves really fast in state institutions, and it's probably true across the board. But there is a process, and I had to follow it. And so that's what I began in the summer of 22.
Now, you said this was a 2-year process. So, how long has your program been officially an MLS program?
We literally became a program about a year ago.
Okay.
And that story, so there's some nuances there. All of our curriculum right now, our prefixes are still CLS. We can get into this a little bit, but I had to start with a program name change, and that included the degree, because to Taiwana's part, it used to be BSCLS. It was last summer. This summer in August, when my seniors graduate, they will have a BSMLS. So that was the first part. And then just because it's Texas State's policy, right behind that, I had to click the lever to start the curriculum change. And so we've been doing that this year. Last year was more about the program name change and the degree name change, and that got approved and got done. And then once that was in motion, during that process, I had to start another process. These were online portals, by the way. I had to start a process for the curriculum change. And so we have a whole system here. I had to go in with my faculty, and we had to have a justification. And that was easy because I had it through the information I provided for the name change. But we had to go in and literally update every course. So this took some effort. think we had 24 courses, and every course had to go from, you would think it would be a simple box to check. I always tell this story. It's C to M. It's CLS to MLS. It was one stinking letter, but it was also an opportunity for the university to go, okay, no, we have to review all your coursework now when you do this. So I had to go in and not just the prefix, but update the course rationale, for example. And if you're not academia, there's all this stuff behind the scenes, right? The bibliography, the objectives, the high level objectives, the low level objectives, and quite a bit of effort there. And so my faculty were huge helps there because we each took a chunk and we worked through that. We got it all entered into the system. And literally it went through different committees. So there was a college curriculum committee that okayed it. That was last fall. In January of 24, we met in the university level curriculum committee, met. We went through every course and we had to answer questions. They approved it. And then we're good. Right now we're in the process of they're putting everything into the proper system so that it's in our fall, so fall 24, this coming fall 24, every class that our students sign up for will be MLS with the appropriate course name. So that's been the last hurdle. It's happened. It's just we're waiting for the fall to cross that finish line there, but that'll officially have everything. And then the other part of the story that you probably realize is that the other ongoing things that are internal to us and we have to think about is, oh, we literally did it this week. We changed all of our signs on our doors to my offices. We've changed the bulletin boards. Our student society is now SMLS instead of SC. We've started on our website, right? Imagine all this stuff you have to do. We started on all our documents, our application to our program. And so we'll probably find things 2 years from now that, oh, we forgot that document. It's been buried in the, it's been buried on the web. And so we'll probably have it 95% done in the fall, but I'm sure there'll be things that pop up here and there that we're like, oh, we never told our clinical affiliates that there's just different things you don't think about until you cross that path. And so that's where we're at now. What did we forget? And we probably don't even know what we forgot. We'll just find out when it happens.
But for sure, the movement starts with our educational programs and making sure that upfront our students understand the degree that they are getting and they're achieving, and then perhaps can start looking at for that specific job when they go out into the field. And that's where all of us in the industry come in. But before faculty or educators that are out there listening and saying, geez, 2 years, and it's a process, and that, or they're in that process and they're facing challenges and they're feeling discouraged and they're just like, well, we could just go ahead and stay CLS. I don't know if you've experienced any positive or negative effects only 1 year in, but what do you hope to see, or what can you say about the positive or the impact that it's had at Texas State to help motivate another program that's out there trying to do this very same thing?
Yeah, I think, let me start with first that it is a journey. Nothing in life typically is a sprint. It's more of a marathon, if you will, but it was absolutely worth it. And I'll start first by saying, I think after I've gone through this, and I'm sure there are other program directors out there that have done it as well, that's why I documented my journey, and it was an honor to do so and share that. And some of those resources I know you'll share when we're done on your podcast, but there's a talk out there about this. There's a full PowerPoint that I put together with other people's help. We have actual step-by-step ways to think about this, and it's doable. That's my message. It's absolutely doable. And the sooner you get started, the sooner you're done. And I think being part of this journey has been really beneficial to my students and alumni. It gave me an opportunity to really educate people, even at my own institution. So there's benefits because it's purposeful, and I had to document stuff, and I'm willing to share all of that. For example, and you'll see this if you look at the presentation over this or the document, the data. I didn't realize, for example, that when you look at the NACLS data around this right now, so in 2019, I'm just looking at some data. In 2019, there were about 61% of the programs in the country were MLS. We had 28% that were CLS. And then there's still some out there, about 10% that are MedTech. And just in a 3-year span from 19 to 22. So remember, I was starting this in 2022, and this is part of the proposal I presented to my leadership. It had already jumped to almost 70%. So it's 68-ish% for MLS. And so progress is happening. And fortunately, at the associates level, it's really high because it's always been MLT for many years. So they're already in the high 90 percentile. So the goal is that we get that moving towards that 90th percentile. And then all of a sudden, if you're not one of those members, then you're going to feel the need to get it there. You don't want to be that last program that's hanging on. It change is never easy. We all have said that many times. For me, it was just that moment of, again, I can't say this enough, being part of the professional organizations and understanding how critical this was. It helped me get over that inertia, and I had a great faculty help. Students were, really excited about it. And even my leadership was excited about it because I think they realized this lets me rebrand and rethink. And down the road, not today, but we're already starting to think about this is going to be beneficial for future master's program or some other type of way to promote our footprint here in Texas, maybe with working professionals to come back and get an online master's degree or something in a particular area. That's coming down the road, perhaps, but it just opened up some new thought and some new look at why we're so important and why we can help the workforce of Texas and beyond. So I don't know if I answered your question other than it's doable and there are people to help. And now we have some templates, I think, to help you think about it. The only little tweaks in there will be it'll be a little different. It may not be that much different at Texas universities if you're within the state, but if you're outside of Texas or you're private, you might have a few different policies or different things you have to do. But usually there is a policy, usually there's a way to do this for program name changes, especially. And then even thinking about hospital-based programs, which I haven't approach those, it might even be quicker because in the corporate world and the healthcare world, sometimes you don't have as much state red tape. And we had to go all the way up through the upper administration into our system level. But it happened. It was all I needed was good data and justification, and there was no pushback. There was just questions. Why? And show me why. And once I had that data, which I gathered pretty easily, in all honesty, things moved along. It was just, and really the time frame, just to be clear for everybody, it wasn't because it was like I was working nonstop for 2 years. There were just times where the university curriculum meeting only happened once a year. And because when you turn over course loads, you can't do that every 3 months. It has to be by a year, an academic year. So you just get caught in this calendar issue because of academic issues. There's no other reason. It's just a timing issue.
Wow. This has been a pretty interesting journey to watch. So I've had the pleasure of sitting on the ASCP's Workforce Steering Committee with Dr. Rohde, and to see this case study play out in real life has been pretty cool to watch his subgroup take on this task of changing the program name. And it's been very interesting watching and seeing you get to this finish line. As you said, it's been a journey. So, Dr. Rohde, as you are continuing on this journey and creating resources, I know that you have some practical advice to give to other educators who are wanting to be in that 68, 70% number of getting their program name changed, but they may not know exactly where to start, and we'll give them a few resources that you've shared with us. But are there other platforms, websites, or collaborator groups that they could go to, whether they are at state facilities or hospital-based programs? And then I want you to talk a little bit about any unexpected consequences that might have come during this journey and unexpected costs. So, as laboratorians, we are all about the money, right? So, we want to know, are there unexpected costs? And you talked about a few things that made me think about that as far as costs: nameplate update, website update, book change, those kind of things. So, there could be people out there, educators that are on the journey, but really want to know as they are starting to tackle this, all of the considerations that they need to make. So what practical advice that
Let's start with, and remind me if I forget about the cost. I'll come back to that next. But first, let's resources of where to start and things like that. We've really talked about the big ones. So the Blueprint for Action is, you can Google it really quickly, or you can go to ASCP's website and find that'll unfold for you. There's multiple things to look at. And I would encourage you, if you're a medical laboratory professional, whether you're in academia or out there working, to check it out. There are still opportunities, I think, to serve and to help on some of those subcommittees and committees, as Taiwana knows. I think this is going to be a process that moves forward. There may be turnover in leadership and new people coming in because you need new ideas and new energy. So I think that'll be going for a while because this is an ongoing process. So I would start there. Certainly ASCLS and NACLS and those types of organizations, if you have your own slant on different organizations, they probably have some information around this. But those are probably the big ones to begin with. And then because of what we've done so far, and as you will share, I know because I've sent it to you, there is a YouTube presentation of, it's not just my presentation, it's multiple people on this workforce committee that have done different things, including NACL's representation and others. And so that would be a resource to check out for sure. I'm certainly willing to share it's all out there now, but if you want to holler at me, I'm happy to send you things. And then the other resource I think you really need to start with is your university, whether it's state, whether it's private, whether it's associate degree. If you're at a community college and you're still thinking of a name change, that's probably a little more rare, but maybe, or a hospital program. And so I think you start there and you talk to your leadership about, this is a movement. This is a national movement within our professional organization and profession. Again, that goes back to the data that you can see now. I've actually shared that with the video and the PowerPoint that's out there. And it's not difficult to gather, and you can grab what I have. It just may need updating, and you may need to tweak it for your own university's needs. I had to put together a 3-page proposal. Part of that was just text, kind of the background that we've talked about. You can use the ASCLS white paper. You can use the other ASCP information that we've talked about to help you build some of that background. And then I had a couple of tables showing what I just told you, the percentage changes over the years. And then that was it. And then I just had to work that information through the various trigger points, the dean, the provost level, and it just went through the process. And again, that was over a timeline because that's the way it works at universities. And it wasn't hard. It was just understanding the process and doing kind of the legwork to get it moving. So those are my points on resources. Your podcast today will be a resource, certainly, once it's out there. So I would encourage you to stay in touch with this podcast and others that discuss these types of changes. I've done a little bit of this with other groups, so you might see it pop up in other places. Again, I do want to mention, as I keep talking, this is more than the Rodney Show. So many people, so many professional organizations across the laboratory space. We have, as Taiwana knows, we have representation from cytology, PA. It's huge. It's a big kind of effort. But getting back to the cost, let's talk about cost. Interestingly, it wasn't really that big a deal, at least so far. Probably the cost that I have seen was just in hours and human manpower to do some of this extra work. But I want to caution everybody that it wasn't a massive amount of just weeks and weeks of working nonstop. It was a little burst of time where I might have to take, when I did my proposal, I probably put in maybe an 8-hour time period over multiple days of writing it and refining it and making sure, because I'm an OCD person, I wanted it to be just right. But a day, really, if you think about it, and then it moved along. And then the curriculum was some effort. Sometimes it was a lot of effort for a few hours at one point, and then it was laid back for a while. So it was an ebb and flow, manageable with my work time, especially if you involve your faculty and other people to help you, which I would encourage you to have them buy in. That's part of the process. But really not a lot of cost. We've had to spend a little bit of money, really not much money at all, on things like just nameplate changes and things like that. Our web changes are all free. It's just going and doing it online, and it's more time than money. And so I don't think I had more than a few hundred dollars cost, if that, because it really, and some of it may be out of my purview. Maybe there was a cost to, but I doubt it. We don't even have printed catalogs anymore. It's all online. So everything is pretty much just digitally changed. Transcripts are digital. I just don't think there's much of any cost to the university or to my program. Financially, it's been no issue for us to go through this process.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I see just the fact that you stepped up and you have a blueprint for others to follow. It's amazing. And you are getting support from others. I really love that. I know this is a major resource for others to come back to. You shared a lot of resources that we can share, and this is great. Is there anything that we didn't ask, we didn't discuss, that you'd probably want to add as we wrap up?
I think, again, just, I've said this a couple times, but just to really bring it home, I just want to thank everyone that's been involved in this process. From the beginning, people that I haven't even named that have helped me understand this so many times in the past, and to where we are now. It's been like most things in life. Things don't happen overnight. It's a process, and so many people and so many organizations that have helped me along the way. And it's not me, it's my program, but the bigger umbrella is the profession and so many people that represent this effort and change beyond my program. So I'm just happy that I was able to help. I hope it's useful. If you find during your process, I would urge you, if you find some differences or some hurdles that were really problematic or things that were really better than what I've talked about, let us know. And certainly let the professional organizations know and NACLS know and others, because anything we can do to smooth out the road ahead for other people, the better the journey will be for others. So I just, again, thank you guys for allowing me to share this information. And I want to thank everyone from the bottom of my heart that really put in the time and the effort and the work.
Yeah. So thanks for being that poster child for this. But there are other educators who are out there that may be thinking of trying it, and they want to reach out to you maybe directly or connect with you in other ways. Could you share how people could reach out to you, connect with you, to have further discussion on this?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So there are multiple ways. If you're on LinkedIn, many of them on LinkedIn and other platforms, so I'm happy to interact with you there. The one quick thing, and you see it on the screen, sometimes my last name gets mixed up. It's R-O-H-D-E. A lot of people will misspell that, so just be careful you're getting the name right. Texas State University, if you look me up via Texas State University, you can quickly find me within the program. My email's available. It's also available via LinkedIn. And so, yeah, just any of those, even the professional organizations. Many of you out there are interacting with the member communities, ASCP through ASCLS and others. I'm pretty active in all of those organizations. It's not just me. There are many people that are able to help with this. Get out there and interact with individuals and start thinking about what you can do to get this consolidation going.
Before we let you go, Dr. Rohde is like our fourth co-host. He is a friend to the show.
The check's in the mail, right?
It's a very overrated job. You've been a guest on our show for so many times, I think four at least. And we want to ask you before you go just one last question, but there is a catch to this question, Dr. Rohde. Can you name a guest that you feel like would be beneficial for our audience to hear, see, or has a message to share? But there is a catch, because the name you name, you have to help us get this person on the show. So if you name Blair Holiday or something, then you need to be helping and get him on the show.
You haven't had Blair on?
Not yet. Is that who you're going to say? Is that who you're going
to say? That's definitely, I think all of us should think about that. I think he'd be fun to talk to. You know, there are so many people I actually would love to recommend. And I'll think about this even beyond what I'm about to say, because sometimes it goes back to our point earlier and in other shows, sometimes people don't know how to end up on a podcast. I mean, I would have never known if somebody wouldn't have reached out to me. I think it's a good idea, Stephanie, for all of us to think about that, because I certainly don't want to overwhelm you by sending you name after name, but I definitely have some thoughts around different things. If it's like a narrow area, like laboratory stewardship for antimicrobial resistance, have you guys talked to Andrea Prinzi, Dr. Prinzi? She's been on some other podcasts. She's really an amazing microbiologist. She's also a patient advocate. She works for BioMérieux, but she came out of the microbiology labs in Colorado and a really good friend, but an outstanding academic scientist and practical clinical person trying to better things around antibiotic resistance. Just really phenomenal speaker. I would really recommend her. And then when you think about what we've been talking about, I think, have you guys had a Dr. Harrington on, Susan Harrington?
We have not. How did we miss that?
I think she would be a wonderful resource. She's with Cleveland Clinic, and she's been leading our Blueprint for Action Workforce Committee. Taiwana knows the effort she's done. Gosh, I could go on and on. Many of the people you probably know, but certainly I think those two, one's more broad, one's more kind of microbiology focused, but I have others I've interacted with. One of the greatest things I've had going on in my life the last 10 years is interacting with other professionals so they learn about us. For example, a pharmacist. I've written some articles and done some things in the interplay of antimicrobial resistance, how critical pharmacy is and the lab. Got some names there if you're interested in bringing on different professionals who appreciate the medical lab. They are wonderful advocates for us. And so sometimes I found that's been helpful to work with others, right? Beyond our immediate circle of colleagues, to get out there and look at pharmacists and physicians and nurses and, you know, just people that can really help us raise that awareness and visibility.
Dr. Rohde, we are going to charge you with getting us your contact list, your address book.
No worries.
We could talk to some of these other professionals, because here at Elaborate Topics, we like to give those practical strategies, whether it's leadership, whether it's technical strategies, or other avenues, alternate pathways for medical laboratory professionals, as well as friends of the laboratory. So those nurses, those physicians, those other avenues that we may not historically think about are important for us here. So we are going to hold you to it.
Absolutely.
We're going to hold you to getting some of these guests, because we like to talk with other people and give our audience, because we have a global audience that are always looking for information and looking to do things differently and understand things differently. So, Dr. Rohde, thank you for coming to the show. It's actually been very fun, very informative, and as always, it's nice to have you inside of our learning laboratory. So thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. It has been a blast. I look forward to the fifth time. I can't wait to come back. So take care of yourselves and keep on doing what you're doing. You're doing great work, and I can't wait to see these episodes pop out there.
Thank you so much, and we are going to hold you to that as well. So we can't wait to get you back. So thank you so much. Thank you for all that you are doing for the profession. We really appreciate your efforts. So listening audience, our time today has come to a close. It's time to wrap up this episode. Please make sure you share it out with a friend, share it out with a colleague, share it out with somebody who can be an advocate for the laboratory, even if they are not directly into our space. The name does matter. It does matter to get that visibility out there. And together we are stronger, together we are better, and it will take all of us to make our industry in the forefront known to everybody as medical laboratory science, the industry that really makes a difference in healthcare. So thank you so much for tuning in. Share this episode out. Make sure you stay connected with us. If you would like to hear a topic, you could leave it in our LinkedIn group, or you can reach out to us individually. You know where we like to play, which is LinkedIn. So connect with us there. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, my friends, have an amazing day.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Elaborate Topics, where your hosts discussed relevant strategies for laboratory professionals. Please subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast platform and listen to us on directimpactbroadcasting.com. Stay tuned for another episode with information you can use to excel in your laboratory career.